This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. After this unprecedented week of political violence, fueled by President Trump himself and followed by a flood of resignations from his own staff, we were wondering how history will remember these final days of the Trump presidency. Presidential historian Gleaves Whitney joins us now. He was the longtime director of the Hausenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. He now serves as executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation. Gleaves Whitney, welcome back to Stateside.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back.
Let's begin with a little late breaking news. President Trump tweeted today that he will not attend the inauguration. How many times has this happened before?
Well, it has happened occasionally where somebody has decided to, you know, to sort of boycott the inauguration. I know John Adams was pretty upset with Thomas Jefferson back in the election of 1800, inauguration of March of 1801. And it happens occasionally in U.S. history. But I think it's of a piece with, I don't think anybody would be surprised that Donald Trump would decide this. He continues to claim falsely that the election is illegitimate. So, you know, this is his exit. And frankly, I think it's fine. It will probably be less disruptive not to have him actually on the platform and having media interviews and that kind of thing.
Can you recall a less peaceful transfer of presidential power than what we're experiencing this year?
Well, you ask a great question. And we tend to forget that in U.S. history, we've had a lot of contentious elections in the past. The election of 1876, of course, where Rutherford B. Hayes ends up being the president. And then, of course, also the Civil War election, impending Civil War at 1860, in which Abraham Lincoln, his election spurred, of course, a lot of states all of a sudden to secede. So I don't want to say this is the worst. But I will say this, the behavior we saw a couple of days ago on Wednesday was the single most disruptive presidential act in U.S. history, where you had a sitting president incite a mob to violence and insurrection and to go in strength to the Capitol. Now, whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump hater, I'm not here to encourage any side. I'm speaking in a nonpartisan fashion, but I am saying that that is a historic event. It will go down in the textbooks, as it should, as the single most disruptive act of a president of the United States. It has never happened before. We have had, of course, many instances in which strong disagreements resulted in partisan outrages. We've had people beat up, of course, on the floor of the House. We almost had fisticuffs the other night in the U.S. House. But I have never seen anything quite like what we saw on Wednesday in all of my study of history.
Gleaves, I think we need to just sit with this for a minute. Do you think it rises above the chaos that's been caused by assassinations in U.S. history?
In terms of the president himself precipitating the disruption, obviously when Kennedy was assassinated and other assassinations, but the presidents themselves were not precipitating the disruption. In terms of a president of his own volition going to talk to a crowd of people and inciting them to basically storm Capitol Hill and mount an insurrection, that's unique. I mean, as was rightly pointed out, we haven't seen anything like this since 1814, where the Capitol itself was invaded. And of course, those were foreigners. That was the British Army that invaded. These were our own people this time. These were American citizens, our brothers and sisters, who were misguided and who stormed the Capitol.
Do you have concerns about what future presidents may feel freed to do by the events of this week and indeed the last 4 years? Have we reached a new normal in how politics seeps into the precedence of the presidency?
Well, I'll tell you, there's something that happened that I want to mention, and I'll answer your question directly after I mention this. We need to be clear about who the revolutionary is here. It is certainly possible to make an argument that the progressives want to move us in, I would say, a revolutionary direction. And I respect people who have concerns. They make their argument in the marketplace of ideas. We listen. That's all legitimate. But let's be clear that it was Mr. Trump who was calling for revolutionary behavior when he was trying to negate the Electoral College by having the Congress decide who the slate of electors should be. The Congress, at his bidding, decide who was legitimate and illegitimate in counting of the electoral votes. That's the revolution that was happening on Tuesday and Wednesday, was that Congress would negate the role of the states in our federal system. That's what he was calling for. And I think we need to be clear about that. But here's the lesson. The Congress stood firm. The states, even the states run by Republican executives and having Republican majorities in their legislatures, often pushed back. The media were vigilant. I think that our American institutions showed on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday that they were resilient, they were strong. And that's perhaps the strongest signal we can send to any potential mischief in the future, unconstitutional activity in the future. Americans will not put up with that. The institutions prevailed. I mean, I'll be quite frank with you. I'm not always a fan of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in their roles and their leadership in the House and the Senate, respectively. But you know what? They did their constitutional duty yesterday, and they stood up to the president and they said, Cabinet, are you going to invoke the 25th Amendment? If you do not, we think the behavior of this president has been sufficient to start the proceedings for a re-impeachment. Well, those are institutional, lawful responses to what happened. That's what we're talking about here. Any future president who wants to do the same kinds of things that Mr. Trump has done will find our institutions are strong, they're resilient, and they will push back.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Gleaves Whitney. He's the executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation, formerly of Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, as we're having this conversation, two of Donald Trump's cabinet members have announced their resignations, and a number of other key staffers are also stepping down. They say this is all in response to what happened on Wednesday. And as you say, lawmakers are calling for the use of the 25th Amendment. First of all, would you review what the benchmark is for the 25th Amendment? What exactly has to be shown about the president's capacity?
Yes, that's a good question. And also, let me just preface anything more I say, and this would cover everything I've said up to this point. I am speaking in my private capacity as a citizen, and my views that I'm expressing on your show do not represent the views of the foundation, the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation itself. So I want viewers to know, if they want to hurl bricks at me, not to hurl them at the foundation, but at me. You know,
of course. We called you for your scholarly expertise.
Okay. Well, the 25th Amendment sets up, of course, President Ford was the first vice president and president installed under the terms of the 25th Amendment. It is invoked when there is either a crisis in the presidency itself, where the president is either too ill or regarded as incapacitated physically or perhaps mentally or behaviorally and no longer fit to serve as president. And the 25th Amendment comes out of the assassination, the sad day, November 22nd, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and our lawmakers got together and they said, we really need to provide a mechanism for always having the orderly transfer of power, constitutional means. So it was ratified, I believe, in 1967, so 4 years after Kennedy was assassinated. But that was the precipitating event behind the 25th Amendment, always to have an orderly transfer of power and the ability to select a new vice president should the vice president advance to the presidency. So we're now at a point where the discussion, as you know, is, has President Trump's behavior shown evidence of a lack of fitness to hold the office, either because it's erratic or there is a question of mental competence or emotional stability to perform the duties of the presidency? I'm not in a position to judge those questions. I'll leave it to your listeners to come to their own conclusions about Trump's behavior. But the point is, it's constitutional. It is the regular method for the orderly transfer of power to the vice president, should it be necessary. And that's the thing that we need to respect through this whole process. Not lawlessness, not mobs, but the constitutional provisions we have at our disposal as Americans to keep democracy's greatest country going in an orderly manner.
I believe Gerald Ford is the only president to take office as a result of the 25th Amendment, correct?
That's correct. In 1974, upon Nixon's resignation, it was clear that President Ford, who had not been elected to be vice president, he had not been elected to be president. He became the first president in American history not elected by the people, who served in both of those capacities. And you know the rest of that story. He served, and then he ran, of course, on his own in 1976 for his own first term, and did not quite make it to the White House that way. He had to leave the White House in January 20th, 1977. And, you know, he served with dignity in his 3 years in office.
The most recent cabinet resignation is Education Secretary and our fellow Michigander, Betsy DeVos. How common are end-of-term resignations?
They're not that common, or the reason for end-of-term resignations is that people start getting jobs. I mean, they go, often people, let's be frank about this, often people who serve in the cabinet are fairly well-to-do. They have some means, and they don't necessarily need to be in a cabinet position. But there are people also who do not come from, say, an entrepreneurial background, or they're not, you know, people who've acquired a lot of wealth, and they frankly need to find a job. Well, that's clearly not the case with Betsy DeVos. She comes from a West Michigan family, two families that have provided considerable means to the family. So she served as an active public service in the Trump administration. She's always had a natural passion for education. So you have to just sort of take all the factors, and that would give you an idea of perhaps what motivated her, and of course her words too, to resign. But it's, you know, people want to move on with their lives. When you have a lame duck president, he's going to be going out. People often decide that it's time to move on to, you know, because they can contribute at a higher level. That actually often happens.
If Betsy DeVos does step down right now, and if the president's cabinet were to invoke the 25th Amendment, it certainly seems like Betsy DeVos would not be obliged to take part in a vote to remove the president from office. Can we assume that that's part of the math here?
Well, I don't want to get into anybody's specific motives because I've not had any private correspondence with Secretary DeVos to confirm that kind of thinking. But, you know, when Elaine Chao, Betsy DeVos, it's been commented that by resigning, then they would not be party to any vote in the 25th Amendment to remove a president from constitutional office. So, you know, it would be unfair to the individuals involved for me to speculate. I'm sure when this question comes up, some people will have that calculus in their mind, and we will know later the extent to which, when they write their memoirs or their articles in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, their op-eds, we will know the extent to which it actually played a part in their decision-making.
Gleaves, how do you think the history books are going to write about what's happening right now?
As an historian, I saw immediately the gravity of what was happening. And it really, I think it started when the transcript from last Saturday, it hasn't even been a week, what a week it's been, the transcript of the call with the Georgia Secretary of State, Raffensperger, came out. I had friends of mine who were highly supportive of Trump. They were calling just to inquire, you know, what to make of this. And I said, well, I think we have to be clear that this is a coup, in a sense, against our federalist system, and history must record it as such. The audacity, the brazenness to nullify the role of the states in our election, that is a serious problem. You can't have a president do that, try to do that unilaterally, and bully his vice president into changing the results, not only of the states, but then of the Congress, accepting and counting the slate of electors that the states send to Congress. That is a sacred federalist principle. The national government should not be party to that. So this was a serious offense. It was unconstitutional. It probably, I mean, when the way I interpret it, maybe I'm wrong, but I read the transcripts and I interpret the tone, listening to the president's conversation with the Georgia Secretary of State, it sounded like, find me 11,000 votes. Can't do that in our system. It's wrong.
What do you think historians will ultimately say about the outcome of the 2020 election?
That the United States proved to be an amazingly strong, resilient democracy. Our institutions worked. The Constitution has remained intact. The delicate federalist system that we have that balances power between the national government and the states worked when even people of the president's own party in the executive branch of state government and the legislative branches of state government pushed back. And they said, no, this is not going to happen. I think that will be the most impressive thing down the road that our historians will be writing about. But I always caution, you know, it takes 50 years, believe it or not, it takes 50 years, according to most historians, to really evaluate an event and to get all those memoirs, diaries, all the commentary out there. And we always have to wait to see what happens in the next administration to put this administration in context. You asked a question that was very suggestive earlier. Will a future president take the worst parts of the Trump presidency and his personal behavior and try to imitate it? We'll see if a future president does so. That will also cast light on what happened from Saturday to Thursday of this week.
50 years to think about it and come to conclusions. I'm a little jealous.
I know. It'll be fun, though. There'll be a lot of commentary on this. This is a benchmark. It's an ugly benchmark, but it's a necessary benchmark for the vitality of our democracy. So I'm proud of our institutions and our spirit as Americans for allowing the institutions to work as they were. The media have played a role in broadcasting what was happening, and the Congress stood up and did the right thing to reject essentially what would have been a revolutionary act to throw the states overboard. I mean, I'll put it this way. I never thought I would be defending the Electoral College against some of my friends on the right. I'll just put it that way. Usually those attacks on the Electoral College come from the left. It just shows how crazy our times are.
For sure. I have to ask you, you came to this job as director of the Gerald Ford Presidential Foundation relatively recently, toward the end of 2020. There was this moment on Wednesday when the Trump supporters who broke into the Capitol hung the Trump campaign flag on the statue of Jerry Ford that is in the Capitol building, and they stuck a MAGA hat on his head. How would that have sat with our 38th president?
Well, I've been asked this by a number of people and also other interviews, and I got to tell you, President Ford would be heartbroken at what happened from this period, say, Saturday through Wednesday and Thursday. And there is no question that he would have been outraged that a hooligan would have climbed his statue, mounted his statue under the rotunda there of the Capitol, put a flag in his arm, and put a hat on his head. That would be questionable at best whether he would have endorsed the values of such flag and hat. President Ford, remember, was somebody who respected our Constitution, our institutions. He was somebody who believed it was necessary to reach across the aisle to people with whom you disagree. We're all in this marriage as American citizens together. We got to make it work. It's not an easy marriage. It's a tough marriage. Sometimes we want to divorce each other. But you know what? We're here. We're in it. We got to make it work, and we've got to do it without coming to blows. So many of the values that President Ford has held dear, the values of civility and decency and knowing the right thing to do without resorting to a poll, those values were violated by that mob that stormed the rotunda and the rest of the Capitol, and they were violated by the hooligan who mounted his statue and put that flag in his arm and a hat on his head. Terrible, disappointing, outrageous.
Gleaves Whitney is executive director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation, formerly with the Housenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Gleaves, thank you so much. What a strange moment. Thanks for helping us interpret it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I always love your show. You guys do a great job.